Okay, let's close the eyes. You're sitting up comfortably tall. Relaxed. Let's recite Om three times. Inhale. We always begin with an invocation. It's an invocation to sage Patanjali. Any discussion when we start, Patanjali's discussion, we always recite this. There's a little tune to it. So you can either listen to me with the eyes closed or you can read on the screen. Yogen chittasya padena vacham malam sharirasya cha vaidyakena yopakarottam pravaram muninam patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. So this is an invocation to sage Patanjali. And Sonal, you want to read the meaning loud?
Sure. I respectfully bow down with folded hands and offer my salutations to sage Patanjali, the highest among the munis. Oh, if you can.
What happened? Oh.
The highest among the munis who has presented the remedies for removing the impurities of the body through his treatise on Ayurveda, of language through his treatise on grammar, and impurities of the chitta, which is a mind field, through his treatise on yoga, yoga sutras of Patanjali.
Very good. So as you can see, Patanjali is given credit for three basic sciences that are useful for human consumption: body, mind, and speech. So the three most important things, body, mind, and speech. And Patanjali has been given credit for all three of them. He was the originator, or at least one of the main commentators on the Ayurveda. Authors of Ayurveda, which is the science of medicine, and grammar, Sanskrit grammar. His commentary is considered to be one of the most widely used commentaries on Sanskrit grammar. So he was a grammarian. And of course, yoga for calming the mind. Okay, so yoga was for the mind. So body, mind, and the speech. Okay, so what we've been doing here is the study of the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, which is considered to be the most authoritative text on the concepts of yoga, so to say. What is yoga? What's the background, etc., etc. they can call it the codification of the science of yoga. Many moons ago, some say 2, some say 3, 4,000 years ago, doesn't matter. He did not invent anything new. I mean, the knowledge apparently already existed. He just put it together in a format which was easily understand. Well, not easily, but it was at least put together.
It's written down.
Okay. Not at that time written down. But it was just put together in a form that people could memorize and transmit orally to the next generation. At that time, in those days, there was no instruments for writing things down. Nothing much. I mean, there were things like palm leaves and big leaves and all that that you could write on. But the story goes that Patanjali made somebody write the whole thing, and in the night a goat came and ate all those leaves. And then goat had to take a rebirth at some time, you know, and then create this. And it's all kinds of stories. Okay, so, but orally, you know, this tradition has lived on for all these years, and then that's how we have it now. Okay. Very, very quickly and briefly, these Yoga Sutras has four chapters: Samadhipada, Sadhanapada, Vibhuti, and Kaivalya. Those are the names of those chapters. Pada is a chapter. Pada is also a quarter. Okay, and the first chapter, Samadhi, Pada, is the definition of yoga and Samadhi. What is the concept of Samadhi? What is the concept of yoga? What the definition of yoga is, etc., etc. All those concepts are given in the first chapter. The second chapter is called Sadhana, Pada. Sadhana means the means of something, or the methodology, or the technology of whatever you are trying to do. So what are the means of achieving the objectives of yoga? That's called the Sadhanapada, second chapter. It also actually starts with an understanding of what kleshas are. Kleshas, in a modern sense, you can translate them as stress, for lack of a better term. Okay, suffering, pain, mental anguish. These are the meanings for klesha. But in modern terminology, everything boils down to stress, right? So what is stress, what causes it, and what are the means of eliminating that stress, which is the purpose of yoga, is to eliminate stress. That's the whole goal of yoga, is all given in the second chapter. It starts with what's called the eight limbs of yoga. And that's the focus that we are doing right now, eight limbs of yoga. And today we'll continue with that focus after this brief introduction. Okay, so eight limbs of yoga, five of them are covered in the second chapter, and then it continues to third chapter. For meditation, it goes into the third chapter. The three limbs of meditation are covered in the third chapter, and then it goes into a great length of discussion on what meditation can do in terms of giving us supernormal powers, powers that are normally beyond human capability. By practicing yoga and deep states of meditation, you can attain those powers. Okay? So that all is given in chapter 3. It's called Vibhuti. Vibhuti is supernormal power. Supernatural, supernormal power. Vibhuti. The final chapter is called Kaivalya Pada. Kaivalya means freedom in a sense. Aloneness, freedom. Freedom from what? Freedom from this bondage that we are experiencing in life, bondage between, you know, my true being and my artificial being, so to say, and, you know, that's all the purpose of yoga, is to identify what my true identity is. And once I know what my true identity is, that state is called Kaivalya. And then going into some more details of what that state is, and what are the different intermediate stages, and what are the, you know, different aspects of that Kaivalya state. That's all in the chapter 4. Okay, so that a very, very broad sense, that's the four chapters. And what we did in the first few talks here, I started with chapter 1, and we went through the definition of yoga. And then there are these concepts called vrittis, or the fluctuations that go on in the mind. And the whole idea of yoga is to calm those fluctuations, calm this constant
chatter that we have going on in the mind, okay, and how to do that, etc. That's the first part of chapter 1. So we did that first. And then we jumped into the second chapter, into the 8 limbs of yoga. So that's what we are discussing these days. And again, a very quick review. We've covered up to, last time we covered up to, you were here last time? No, you were not here. Dave?
October was the last time I was here.
So you missed November.
I missed November.
Mahi, you were there.
I was here in November, but I think I was there for about hour and a half.
Yeah, okay. Less. So you are the only person who was there in November.
I might have been here in November. You didn't do December.
No, not December and January I missed.
I think I might have been here in November.
November you were here?
I thought.
Okay. Anyway, so my question would be, do you remember what we did or you forgot?
No. Well, I write it down.
That's a good
so
question.
I know that we were planning to go to the chapter 2, because I have just made a note here. In the first chapter, we did up to 33, and then we said, let's go to 228. And that's where we left off.
Yeah. No, that was October then.
Right. Yes. You started
that was October. In November, we covered...
November...
I covered...
Yeah, November, yes. I have made some notes here. Yes.
I said, completely forgetting everything.
No, I remember.
Okay, no, let me...
We went to 228 in November, and then we did 228 and 29...
We did up to Satya and Ahimsa. Those are the two... Yamas we covered. I can just tell you now, okay? But I'm going to go over all that a little bit briefly one more time,
okay.
just everyone can come on board, okay? So this is the introductory sutra for introduction of the 8 limbs of yoga, okay? It's a very, very beautiful and very powerful sutra. And is it okay if I go through the whole thing again?
Mm-hmm, sure. Yeah.
Is it okay, Dave, for you also?
Repetition always helps.
It helps. Okay. So then I'm going to assume that we are going through this afresh, you know, not having gone through it. So what we normally do, those who are new here, we go through the Sanskrit first, so I'm going to say these words one at a time and you will repeat after me. Okay, so that we know what the Sanskrit is, and then we go through the meaning word by word, okay? So that every word of every sutra we're going to try and understand the Sanskrit and its meaning in English. Okay? If that's okay with everyone, that's what we have been doing. Okay, Yoganga. Anushthanat. Ashuddhi, Kshaye, Jnana, Deeptihi, A, Vivek, Khyatehe. One more time. Yogang, Anushthanat, Jnana, Deeptihi. No. Ab Yogang Anushthanat, Ashuddhi Kshaye, Jnana Deeptihi, A, Vivek Khyatehe. Alright, that's, we've covered the Sanskrit part now. What does it mean? Yogang, Anga means limbs. Yoganga means limbs of yoga. So now he's talking about these 8 limbs of yoga. Anga. Anushthanat. Anushthan means to follow, to practice something, to follow something. Anushthanam. So through the practice or through following these 8 limbs of yoga, okay, Ashuddhi Kshaye. Ashuddhi means
impurities.
And Kshaye means to diminish, to eliminate the impurities. That means when you practice these 8 limbs of yoga, the impurities of the mind, they diminish. They get eliminated. So we purify the mind. Okay? We get rid of impurity, that means we purify the mind. Ashuddhi Kshaye. What happens then? Jnana Deeptihi. Jnana means?
your intellect.
Knowledge, intellectual or pure knowledge. Jnana. Deepti means light. So the light of pure knowledge will shine through. That's Jnana Deepti. Okay? And A means until. Until Viveka Khyati happens. What's Viveka Khyati? It's pure discriminatory knowledge or wisdom as to who you are. What is my true identity? That's what I started with. What my true identity is, that's our goal, that's our objective. What he's saying is, through the practice of these eight limbs of yoga, all my impurities of the mind will be diminished. And because there are no more impurities to clutter my mind, I can see the light of true wisdom.
Is wisdom a technical term, or is it just another kind of knowledge?
Now, I'm kind of rounding off the meaning of Viveka.
Okay.
Viveka means pure discriminatory wisdom. That means I can discriminate between right and wrong, good and bad, evil and right, things like that. That kind of discriminatory wisdom, it's called Viveka. And knowledge of that wisdom, that's called Viveka Khyati. Okay, so I'm kind of, like I said, and I'm putting words around the whole thing.
Okay.
So hopefully we can understand all this. So that's the meaning of this whole sutra. Everyone clear with that? So through the practice of eight limbs of yoga, I'm going to eventually become self-realized. That's the main reason. Self-realized because of my Viveka Khyati, because I know exactly who I am. I have realized myself. I have realized my own true nature. I'm self-realized. Okay. This is just a listing of the eight limbs of yoga. Yama, everyone. Yama.
Yama.
Niyama.
Niyama.
Asana.
Asana.
Pranayama.
Pranayama.
Pratyahara.
Pratyahara.
Dharana.
Dharana.
Dhyana.
Dhyana.
Samadhi.
Samadhi.
These are the Ashtau. Repeat that. Ashtau.
Ashtau.
Angani.
Angani.
That's the statement. Ashtau Angani means eight limbs of yoga are listed here. Okay? So, does everyone want to repeat one more time? Yama.
Yama.
Niyama.
Niyama.
Asana.
Asana.
Pranayama.
Pranayama.
Pratyahara.
Pratyahara.
Dharana.
Dharana.
Dhyana.
Dhyana.
Samadhi.
Samadhi.
Okay? So, these are the eight limbs of yoga. Yamas and niyamas are the first two limbs. They are considered to be the ethical and moral guidelines in a loose sense. How do you live your life? What are the things to be avoided in life? What are the things to be attached to be taken care of in life? Okay? So, there are five yamas and five niyamas. Okay, and we'll get to the next slide where they will be listing all these. So look at these as ethical and moral guidelines as to how to lead your life ethically and morally. Because that becomes the foundation stone of your yoga, of your life basically. You know, it's the foundation stone of your life. If you're ethically and morally corrupt, nothing can be built on that foundation. Nothing. You know, no matter how much asanas you do, you know, you can do lots of warrior poses and stand on your head and get into a pretzel shape and all that stuff. But if you're morally and ethically corrupt, you'll never get the peace of mind that you're looking for, that yoga is supposed to give you. Okay? So those are the ethical and moral guidelines. Then asana, what does asana mean?
Poses.
Postures.
What kind of postures?
Physical.
Asana means what? Literally. Sitting posture. The root word for asana is as. As in Sanskrit means to sit. As means to sit. And asana is either the posture that you're sitting in or what you're sitting on. Okay, so for example, right now, your asana is the chair. Okay? And his asana is that block. Right? Cushion or bolster is her asana. But the posture that you're sitting in is also called an asana. But it only talks about sitting posture, sitting asana. Okay? Because Patanjali's goal was to tell us that, you know, it's only through meditation that you can attain the objectives of yoga eventually. Objective of yoga being to calm the mind. And to do meditation, he recommends a sitting posture. Okay? Not a standing or a walking posture, not a sleeping posture, not a reclining posture, but he recommends a sitting posture for the purpose of sitting and meditating. Okay? That's asana. But how did that so happen that even this is called asana now? That's much later development. Because when Patanjali said you have to sit down for hours to meditate, when people started doing that, they realized they cannot. They could not sit for more than a few minutes or a few, you know, half hour maybe at most, and then their bodies would be in pain. Their shoulders would hurt, their hips would hurt, legs, knees, ankles, everything would hurt. So, they had to develop these subsequent yogis. They developed these asanas, these postures for building a body which is flexible enough, which is strong enough, which is durable enough, so that it could withstand the journey of yoga meditation. But then rather than giving it a new name for all these poses, they said, let's call it asana. It's okay. So that's how the name asana has been given to all the other poses also. So asana, what is pranayama? Breathing practices. Pranayama is all breathing practices. And then what is pratyahara?
Temptation, holding on.
Holding on to the sense perception, sense attraction,
avoiding sense distractions.
So it's called sense withdrawal. Pratyahara is sense withdrawal. Ahara means food. Any intake that comes into the body is called ahara. Pratyahara, when you add the prefix prati, means opposite of that. Don't allow anything to enter into the body. What enters through the body, into the body? Through the five senses. So pratyahara means do not allow anything entering into the body through the five senses. That's the meaning of pratyahara. Okay? And then finally, those last three are called the three stages of meditation. Dharana, Dhyana, and Samadhi are the three stages of meditation. What is Dharana? Initial focus.
Concentration.
That's the initial concentration. Dhyana is a actual meditating on your object of meditation. Okay, that's Dhyana. And when that meditation on your object deepens enough that there is absolutely nothing else in your mind except that single object that you're meditating on, that's called Samadhi.
So the focus is Dharana or Dhyana?
Focus is Dharana. Then Dhyana is a deeper meditation on your object of meditation, and Samadhi is the elimination of all extraneous thoughts or any other object in the mind except that object of meditation that you're focusing on. And that's called the initial stage of Samadhi. The final state of Samadhi it's called Nirbija Samadhi, seedless Samadhi, where even that object is dissolved now. So even that object that you were meditating on is finally dissolved. That's called the Nirbija Samadhi. Okay. Seedless. No seed. No object. Okay. So those are the eight limbs of yoga. Okay. These are the five yamas now. Five yamas. Ahimsa. Let's repeat. Ahimsa. Satya,
Asteya,
Brahmacharya, aparigraha.
Aparigraha.
Are the five yamas, yamaha. So, one more time. Ahimsa.
Ahimsa.
Satya.
Satya.
Asteya.
Asteya.
Brahmacharya.
Brahmacharya.
And aparigraha.
Aparigraha.
Yamaha.
Yamaha.
That means these are the five yamas. Yama means yam. Yam Sanskrit means control. Yamaha means those guidelines which allow you to, or help you control in some sense or negate in some sense. For example, ahimsa, what does it negate?
Violence.
Satya. Negate lies, truthfulness, satya. Asteya.
Stealing,
non-stealing as asteya. And brahmacharya.
Excessive sense
attraction. And most commonly in the common lingo, it is referred to sexual excesses. Or brahmacharya means controlling your sexual urges. That's the common meaning. But the broader meaning of brahmacharya is controlling all your passions, all your
lust,
craving, lust, all kinds of lustful craving. Let's put it this way. Okay. That's called the brahmacharya. And what is aparigraha? Sorry.
So, brahmacharya would include greed, for example?
Yes. Well, aparigraha involves greed.
Oh, greed. Yes, it's included. That I see.
Aparigraha is greed, non-greed.
Gotcha.
Graha means to grab things. Parigraha is to grab things forcefully. Aparigraha is to let go of any grabbing. No force, no desire to grab things, to hoard things. H-O-A-R-D. That's non-greed. Okay. So that's the five yamas. And what it says is that, let's read this once again. Jati, desha, kala, samaya, anavachinnaha. You know, that's a little longer word. Anavachinnaha. Sarvabhaumaha. Mahavratam. Mahavratam. What Mahavratam means? It's a great vow.
Yeah.
It's Maha. Vratam is a vow that you, something that you undertake as a form of self-discipline. That's called a vratam. And Mahavratam is a great vow. That means it's a supreme kind of a vow. What is the vow? I mean, these yamas, basically he's talking about these five yamas. These are the vows. They are sarvabhaumaha. Sarvabhauma means they are applicable everywhere. Bhauma is, bhumi is earth or space or place or location. Sarvabhauma means applicable everywhere. And samaya avachinnaha. Samaya is time, and it is not dependent on time. What time frame you live in, what place you live in, whether you are in this country or some other country, whether you're living now or you lived in the past, or I mean, time is not a matter. Time and space are no matter. No matter what the time and space, you have to follow these guidelines. Jati desha kala. Jati is, it doesn't matter what species or what lineage you belong to. Desha is, again, location, which country or which location you live in. Kala, what time frame you live in. Samaya, again, time frame. So basically what he's saying is, in a sense, he says that to really undertake the practice of yoga, you have to follow these yamas fairly diligently, irrespective of where you are. jati desha kala samaya avachinnaha sarvabhaumaha. These are sarvabhauma. Mahavratam.
And is there an explanation of why?
Well, there is no, Patanjali doesn't give explanations.
Okay.
Patanjali gives guidelines.
Okay.
Explanations are given by the commentators. The reason being, as I said, in those days there was no printing press, so Patanjali had to keep everything very crisp and very, very rigid, you know, under tight control. Very
terse.
Very terse and cryptic statements. And the commentators, you know, who followed him, they are the people who explain all these things as to why this is so, what Patanjali could have meant. If you read five commentators, you have five different opinions.
Is there some...
There are no...
Go ahead. I was going to say, maybe I'm jumping ahead or something, but are there particular ones that are more distinguished?
Yes. There is a commentary by a person known Vyasa. V-Y-A-S-A. Many people believe that he lived around the same time as Patanjali, and he knew Patanjali personally, apparently. There are some commentators who go as far as saying that Vyasa is another name for Patanjali. Very few in number, those commentators, but there are a few others.
Yes.
This is Vyasa Maharshi you're talking about. Is it
who
Vyasa
knows?
Maharshi? No.
Who knows?
Okay. Not true.
Vyasa.
I see.
Okay. His commentary is considered to be the most authoritative and most authentic. So today, most major commentaries refer to his commentary, and then they give their own interpretation as to what Vyasa might have meant. Vyasa tells us what Patanjali might have meant. And then there are differences in interpreting Vyasa himself. So all these commentators, you know, we read in our Yoga Sutra study group, Laura is a part of that, we study four or five different commentators, you know, writers. Each one is different. They all give you a very different perspective of what the sutra might have meant. Some of them are even contradictory. So you are, in some cases, you're on your own, basically, in interpreting what Patanjali might have meant. There's no clear understanding. And we were doing chapter 4 right now, and we're struggling with some of these statements that commentators make. They don't make any sense. Apparently they just write something and makes no sense.
So does their background makes a difference? Should we look for that? Maybe think about...
Sure.
You know.
Like there's a guy by the name Thymney. He was a scientist, chemical scientist. So a lot of his commentary is geared towards some scientific explanation.
But Patanjali is saying, what he's essentially saying is, if you follow these things, you will reach the goal.
You have a better chance of reaching the goal.
A better chance. Okay, gotcha. You have to apply them and be diligent and all of those things.
Yes. Okay, these are the five niyamas. Okay, you want to repeat? Shaucha. Santosha. Tapaha. Swadhyaya. Ishvara pranidhanani. Niyamaha. Okay, one more time. Shaucha. Santosha. Tapaha. Swadhyaya. Ishvara Pranidhana.
Ishvara Pranidhana.
Pranidhanani is just the plural, so don't worry about that. The word is Ishvara Pranidhana.
Ishvara.
Okay, and these are the five niyamas, niyamaha. So as you could guess, you know, the five yamas, they represented interaction, social interaction with others, okay? All the five. Here, these niyamas are applicable to yourself. They are more in the sense of self-discipline, self-control. Okay? So they apply to yourself. So what are these five? Shaucha means cleanliness, purity. Purity of body, mind, speech, everything. Okay? So that's the cleanliness part, the shaucha. Santosha means?
Happiness,
contentment, being, you know, satisfied, being, you know, as they say, happy-go-lucky, you know, don't worry about anything. That's contented.
Does it imply just an acceptance of what you have?
Acceptance of what you have. It's acceptance, but not at the cost of giving up. I mean, there's element of determination and fight. But then, whatever you get as a result of your endeavors, accept that. That's what the whole concept of acceptance is. Okay? So, that's contentment. And then what is tapaha? Tapas. Tapasya. You know, in India, there is a very common term, tapasya. The yogis, they do tapasya, you know, when
they meditate
or do some studies or make a determination of some kind. Everything is called tapasya, you know. If you decide to wake up every morning at 6 and do some yoga, that's tapasya. Okay? If you decide that you want to donate $1,000 to charity every month, that's tapasya. If you decide that on every Monday you want to have a fast, for example, you don't eat anything, that's tapasya.
Is it sometimes translated as discipline then?
It's a discipline, yeah. Disciplined.
Because I notice it's accepting but not causing pain.
Yeah.
Which is very different.
That's Swami Satchidananda's translation. I don't quite like that translation, but that's okay.
Strong will.
Strong will, yeah.
More than a determination.
It's strong will, you're right. Yeah. Self-control, self-discipline. Basically, the idea of tapas is to put yourself through. Tapas means fire, heat. Okay, you're putting yourself through some heat. They always give the example, you know, of gold, which is purified by intense heat. And we put ourselves through some hardship, some calculated known hardship, so that we become tougher, mentally and physically. That's tapas. Okay? Understand? So if you are fond of watching TV, you can put through yourself through a fast, TV fast for a week. See how that works.
Self-determination.
That's exactly right. You know, these days these terms are very common. TV fast, phone fast, email fast, you know. WhatsApp fast?
Electronic fast.
Electronic fast, you know, all these things. So you put yourself through all that. And there are people in my class who come with their phones and they're constantly looking at the phone while going through the class. They cannot stay away from that even in a yoga class. Okay.
Is there a distinction then between following the rules, being ethical by means of will, as opposed to having purified yourself and it happens naturally?
Obviously, the latter is preferable.
Yeah.
You will need both. You will need the willpower initially. To get to that state where it becomes natural then.
Yes, okay. I like that. You affirm that there is a difference in that is part of what's going on.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
It's not easy to follow these.
It's not. Obviously, it's not easy, yeah. Okay, so that's tapaha, tapas. And what is swadhyaya?
Self-study.
Self-study, also known as study of the scriptures, Because the scriptures, they tell us what the self is all about. So once you know the scriptures, then you can understand, or you can at least, you have a guideline as to how to study the self. So that is Swadhyaya. Okay? Swadhyaya. Ishvara Pranidhana. What's that?
Surrendering to the God?
Surrendering to the Ishvara. Ishvara is? God. Now, we will be spending a fair amount of time going through the concept of Ishvara at some point in time, based on what's given in the sutras. There are at least 6 to 7 sutras which relate to the concept of Ishvara. So we do spend about 2 whole sessions on that, roughly. At least last time we did that. So you'll get a better understanding of what Ishvara is all about. But at a very basic level, you can think of it as Supreme Consciousness or God.
Does it link into any of the Hindu concepts of God, like Brahman and others, or is it something distinct from
that? Again, the commentators feel that Patanjali introduced the concept of Ishvara only because of that feeling that, you know, he obviously belonged to either some sect or some belief in some certain god or something. And therefore, he introduced the concept of Ishvara into Yoga Sutras. See, in the Sankhya philosophy, on which sutras are based, in Sankhya there is no mention of Ishvara. Ishvara is not a part of Sankhya philosophy.
But yoga is not inherently part of any particular religion. Is that correct?
Well,
it is not something that is inherently one religion and not another.
Let me see if I can answer that question. It's going to be a difficult question. See, there are, in the Hindu thought, well, let's not go to Hindu, Indian thought. In the Indian system of philosophy, there are 6 broad philosophical streams. Okay, 6 broad categories of philosophies, you can call them. They are called Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Yoga, Sankhya, Mimamsa, and Vedanta. There are 6 streams of philosophical thought. Okay? And they all, you know, if you talk to a staunch Hindu, he will say it's all Hindu philosophy. But to me, they're basically origins in India. That's it. So I call them Indian thought rather than Hindu thought. Hinduism is let's not talk about that.
No, okay.
That's a different concept there. But these are the Indian streams of philosophical thought, 6 of them. Sankhya and Yoga are very closely related. Nyaya and Vaisheshika are very closely related. Mimamsa and Vedanta are closely related. And someday maybe we can go through these 6, as a part of this discussion someday. I've never done it before, but we can always do that.
So, Ishvara Pranidhana means there is like a belief or accepting God, a supreme God, like.
Pranidhana means to surrender. Sorry. Okay.
Nidhana.
Dha and then nidhana. Yes. And then pra is the prefix. Pranidhana. When you add the pra, from na it becomes ni. That's grammar. Okay. Nidhana means to surrender. And pranidhana is a deep surrender.
God comes into picture.
In Yoga Sutras?
Ashtanga, like 8 limbs.
8 limbs? Well, you know, 8 limbs is part of the Niyamas.
Right.
But then in the Sutra 1 itself, in Chapter 2, there is something called Kriya Yoga. So there he repeats these 3. Tapas Swadhyaya, Ishwar Pranidhana, he calls them Kriya Yoga. And then in chapter 1, there is a statement where it says, he is listing different ways of calming the mind, okay, of keeping the mind very clear and pure. And there again he says, Ishwar Pranidhan is one of the techniques of calming the mind. So there are three different places where Ishwara is brought into the picture. Okay, that's why many commentators believe that, you know, in his view, it was a very, very important concept to recognize the presence of Ishwara and surrender to it. And we'll talk about that. Like I said, we will be spending a lot of time on Ishwara. There are many sutras that relate to that. Okay, so that's the Ishwara Pranidhana. These are the five niyamas. And then this is the continuation. So again, repeat after me. Vitarka Badhane Pratipaksha Bhavanam. Vitarka Badhane Pratipaksha Bhavanam. What is Vitarka?
Discussion.
No, Tarka is discussion. Vitarka is all kinds of negative thoughts. Vitarka is all useless thoughts that come in the mind. So, Vitarka Badhane. Badhane is when you are bound or when you are attacked by these negative, disturbing thoughts. Pratipaksha Bhavanam. What is Pratipaksha?
Opposite.
Bhavanam is feelings or thoughts, imagination, etc., etc. So, bring about the opposite thoughts when you are attacked by negative feelings or thoughts. So
this is the original power of positive thinking.
Positive thinking, yes.
Doing affirmations.
I'm doing affirmations and getting rid of negative thoughts by doing the opposite. If you're angry, how can you be peaceful? If you are trying to hit somebody, how can you be more calm and peaceful, etc., etc. Negative. So when you have negative thoughts, if you're jealous, how can you have the opposite of that? If you're angry, jealous, greedy, all those are negative thoughts, right?
That requires self-awareness now, right?
Yes.
Doing that stuff, right?
Well, that's whole practice of yoga, right? Yep. You have to become more self-aware.
And then self-discipline to change it.
Yep. Change it, yes.
That's the hard part.
Why doesn't it come up?
It hasn't come up, or does it come up later? Ego?
Ego is the main part of discussion of yoga. Ego. Everywhere. We'll get to that. Ego is the main culprit.
Would ego be the mind?
Would ego be the mind? It's a part of the mind. You miss that part of discussion. We do that all the time. But since there is interest, let me just quickly go through that. Can we digress then? Is it okay to digress?
Yeah, that's a good thing to know.
Because since you mentioned ego, because we talk about that in the very first chapter, very first couple of sessions. But very quickly, I'm going to kind of make it brief. So, you know, the whole definition of yoga in the first chapter given, the definition is yoga chitta vritti nirodhaha, which means yoga is by definition the calming of the vrittis of the mind. Vrittis are all the fluctuations, all the changes, all the constant perturbations that go on in the mind. That's called a vritti. And calming those vrittis to get a handle on those vrittis, on those perturbations, that's yoga. Okay? So, mind is the main thing, like Karen was saying, you know, the mind is the main thing here. We have to understand what the mind does, what goes on in the mind. Patanjali doesn't say this, but most commentators, they want us to think of the mind as a composite of four functions. There are four functions going on in the mind. What are these four functions? Manas. Manas is the thinking, the cognition part, cognitive mind, thinking mind. The mind that does all the cognition through the five senses, it activates all the motor actions, you know, all this is done by the mind, that manas part. Okay? Then manas is one, buddhi is the second one. What is buddhi?
Intellect.
Intellect.
The discriminating part.
Discriminating part. That's the intellectual part. Manas, buddhi. Third is ahankara. What is ahankara?
The ego.
The ego. Ego is the ahankara. And finally is the fourth one is the
memory,
which is chitta. Okay. So manas, buddhi, ahankara and chitta are the four major functions of the mind, of this mind. That's why people call it mind field. Okay, because mind is a part of that. So to distinguish, they call it mind field. Okay. So ego is a very important part of this whole discussion then. And how does it all function? And, you know, I always like to give this kind of an anecdotal story that puts all these things together. So the story goes, you know, like this, that at the end of the day, you're coming back from work maybe, and then, you know, at the end of the day, you're maybe hungry. And because you're hungry, you're drawn in the direction of the kitchen maybe. As soon as you get close to the kitchen, you start smelling something nice. So you start smelling something, and then your mind decides it's nice. And then you enter the kitchen, and you're on the countertop, you see a piece of cake sitting there. Okay, that's what was giving the smell. And so, first thing that's getting engaged is the manas. How? Because it's getting input through the five senses. So the first sense that was engaged was the sense of smell. Okay, so and the next sense which is engaged is the sense of sight, because now you're able to see that piece of cake. Okay? And your intuition is to engage the sense of touch next, because you want to dip your finger and feel the texture of this cake, you know, just to get a good feel for what it feels like. And after you've done that, you dip the finger, your next sense that's going to be engaged is the
taste,
because you're going to put it on your tongue and then you feel the taste of it. So you're kind of engaging all the senses now. And by doing that, you have all the information related to the cake. All these senses have been engaged. And then there is a decision to be made now. You know, there are always options. You know, what are the options for us? Eat or not to eat. And who is the decision maker? Buddhi. Buddhi or the intellect is the decision maker. So the mind is now going to, you know, feed all this information to the buddhi. Hey buddhi, this is what it tastes like, touches like, and smells like and everything. What do I do?
Eat.
Now the buddhi, at this, in our present state of the mind, unfortunately or unfortunately, the buddhi is a slave of the ego. That's just how it happens to be. It is not able to make up its own mind independently. This buddhi is driven by the ego. So it goes to the boss. Knock, knock. Boss, what do? I have all this information. Please tell me. The boss, the ego says, okay, let me do some investigation. How do you investigate? You have to have a prior experience to investigate. So it goes into the memory bank called chitta, all right, looks for some information, and it lo and behold, it finds another piece of information, which is what? A week ago, we had the same cake, and then we had put a label after that cake. The label was?
Do not eat.
No?
Is it?
Delicious.
I'm just saying.
Divine. You know, the experience was divine. The most delightful, the most delicious experience. That's the label. Right? That's the label put there. Ego says, ha-ha, look at you, you read the label, it says delightful and divine. Just go ahead and devour the whole thing, you know. Don't even look for it.
Where is the self?
Not in this picture yet.
Okay. Good. Thanks.
It's outside of this picture yet. We're not there yet. Now, it goes back to the intellect. Ego says, okay, go ahead and tell the mind to activate all the motor nerves and do the needful. Okay? Intellect says, you know what? I am the decision maker. Let me do some private investigation of my own. You know, I know my boss says this, but let me just some more investigation, see if I can find something different. And it goes into the memory again. Memory is the only place where you can find stuff, investigate. And it does find something somewhat related. And what is that incident? A visit to the doctor a few days later.
And you gained 5 pounds.
And the blood work, the doctor said the blood work says your cholesterol is dangerously high, you're close to getting a heart attack, and therefore he advised me to go and see a nutritionist right away, which I did. And guess what the nutritionist said? She said, no cake. Dilemma. No cake. Now, Buddhi is very alarmed. Oh my God, I'm not supposed to eat this cake. Boss, 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 look what I find. I'm not supposed to eat this cake. Guess what the boss says?
That's okay, this one time.
He actually is angry. He says, you are a stupid fool. Don't you read the label? It says divine. One time. Right? Like you said, one time. Has one piece of cake killed anybody in this life? So that's the story of the ego.
What is it again? So, buddhi?
Manas, buddhi, ahankara, and chitta.
Ahankara is ego. Ahankara.
Ahankara is the ego.
Chitta is?
Memory.
Memory.
Chitta has all the samskaras, memories, vasanas, lots of stuff there.
So then all this mechanic of this mind is, you know, intelligence is always going and asking ego.
Yes. That's the whole problem. That's the whole problem. That's our dilemma right now, because the intellect is a slave of the ego.
When it is in the core like that, how to avoid ego?
That's Patanjali's job. That's what he says. Practice yoga to kill the ego.
But it's in the core though. It's in the core. How do you kill it?
You will.
Is it killing it or is it controlling it?
Controlling it. Controlling
the ego
it.
Ego will always be there.
It's ego has to be there. It has a function to play. Otherwise, you will never know who you are.
And isn't it also good to have, as long as there is a positive?
Ego has a role to play.
Is always negative or is it?
No. Ego has a role to play. What's the role? Role is to identify your function in life at a given time. Ego is the one which will identify you are a mother at this time. You have to take care of the baby. Ego is the one which says you are the father, you are the worker, whatever, you know. It puts labels on you and for social functioning. Okay, and then once having decided what the label is, what the function is, then it transfers the power to the intellect.
Could you make the case that instinct is part of ego?
Instinct, the word that they use in yoga is more, translated more as intuition.
Okay.
And that term is prajna in Sanskrit.
And that's different from ego.
That's different, totally different from ego. Ego, what ego does is tries to put a lid on that prajna. It tries to put a lid on it. It tries to cover it so that we are not driven by our pure intuitive wisdom. That's the purpose, that's the job of ego. Our job as yoga practitioners is to diminish the influence of ego so that we can actually see the light of that pure wisdom that's coming from the intuition.
So ego is more deep-rooted.
Ego is very deep rooted, yes.
So it could be from your childhood.
It's not from childhood. It's from previous lives.
Oh, okay.
It keeps going.
So the other intuition and temptation, all of those are short term.
We want to make them long term, but you know, right now they don't have a place because ego does not allow them to raise their head. Ego is so strong, it takes over.
It labels.
It labels and then it. It labels and then makes decisions based on those labels. It looks at labels and then makes a decision. Ah, this was good. Ah, this was bad last time. I don't want to have anything to do with this. That's a label and then decision.
If it's so deep rooted, can it really be completely taken out?
No.
Patanjali says it can. Patanjali also says that it will not happen in one lifetime. He says that.
That's when you become self-realized, right?
That's when you're self-realized. That's when the ego is.
Ego for the I sense, right? So you don't want to completely eliminate ego.
I just told you, you know, in my opinion, this ego has a role to play. All these four functions have a role to play. It's what role that I assign to this ego. Am I allowing it to be the boss? Or to be a subservient to what I want to do. I want to keep it in its proper place. That's the role that I want to play. Okay, so that's how ego is, and Patanjali talks a lot about ego. There's no question about that. Okay?
What was the Sanskrit word for intuition again?
Prajna, P-R-J-N-A. No, awareness is different. Prajna is intuition.
What is awareness in Sanskrit?
Awareness, chetana. Chetana. Awareness. That term is not used by Patanjali. Yeah. He just uses purusha or you know, things like that. Drashta. Patanjali uses different terms for all that.
Prajna, or however it's pronounced, Prajna.
It's written as P-R-A-J-N-A, but it's pronounced as Prajna.
Prajna.
Yeah.
That's intuition.
Yes. Intuition.
Jnana,
yeah.
That's knowledge.
Knowledge, yes. And prajna is intuitive knowledge. Okay. So, this is another sutra which talks about why we need to do this pratipaksha bhavanam. Pratipaksha bhavanam, we saw that in the last statement, was the opposite thought. Why is it helpful to give us that opposite thought? So this is what the sutra says here. It says, so you want to repeat after me? It's a long one. Is it okay? Vitarkaha. Hinsadayaha. Krita. Karita. Anumodita. Lobha. Krodha, Moha, Purvakaha, Mridu, Madhya, Adhimatraha, Dukha, Ajnana, Anantaphalaha, Iti, Pratipaksha Bhavanam. A lot of words here. Okay. So, I'm just going to, let's not spend a lot of time on this one. You can, but again, vitarkaha are the negative thoughts that we saw earlier also, same word, vitarkaha. Hinsadaya. Hinsa is?
Violence.
Violence. Adaya means etc. So violence, etc., all these other negative tendencies, when they come up in the mind, whether they are krita, krita means done by you, karita, done by somebody else on your behalf, anumodita means you have given permission, you didn't do it, you didn't ask somebody else to do it on your behalf, but you are okay.
Enabling, yeah.
Or just okay, just being okay. That means you approve of it, in a sense. Anumodana means approve of it. You've
permitted, yeah.
You've permitted it. It's okay for you. Right? So, and it, you know, all these things that, these actions that you did, hinsa, etc., violence, etc., they could be because of lobha. Lobha means?
Stinginess?
Greed.
Greed.
Lobha is greed. Or moha, or krodha. Krodha is anger. The negative violence, you might have done it out of anger or greed. Or moha. Moha means?
Infatuation,
delusion. Yes, very good. Okay. So you could have done these negative things based on anger, greed, infatuation, delusion, etc., etc. Okay. And you could have done it yourself. You could have had somebody else do it on your behalf, or you could have just approved of somebody else doing it. All these things, and they could be in mild format. Mridu is mild. This is like mild medium or rare medium or something, you know. You go to a restaurant, you say rare medium or intense or whatever you call it. Well done. So whether they are rare, medium or well done, that's what mridu, madhya, adhimatra are. All this, once you have understood all this, then you have to understand that these are the cause for dukkha, sorrow, ajnana, ignorance. Okay? So these are the cause, no matter what it is, whether it is violence or any other negative tendency, whether it is done by you or somebody else does it on your behalf, etc., etc., all those things, whether they're done through anger, etc., every one of them is eventually going to give you sorrow, pain, suffering, etc., etc. Once you recognize that, then obviously you will be tempted to do the pratipaksha bhavanam, or the opposite thought of that negative. That's the whole idea of all this. You get the concept? See, the reason I'm going through the Sanskrit words is because that gives us a better sense of what the whole sutra might mean.
So the Ripaksha, I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask, is there a good Sanskrit dictionary?
There are plenty.
There's none that...
No, there is one by Monier Williams.
Oh, I've heard of this one.
Yeah, that's a good one, and it's available online, so you can... Get to the link online and then you can search for any word.
Cool.
Yeah. It's very good. There are two dictionaries which are considered to be the sort of the gold standard. Mm-hmm. One is by Apte, APTE, and the other is Monier Williams. And they're both available online. So, the meaning that I've given based on Swami Satchidananda's translation is, when negative thoughts or acts such as violence, etc., are caused to be done or approved of, whether incited by greed, anger, or infatuation, whether indulged in with mild, medium, or extreme intensity, they are based on ignorance and bring definite pain. Reflecting thus is pratipaksha bhavana. Okay, so what Patanjali has done after this, he has not given us any any explanation of what these five yamas and five niyamas are. He assumes that the commentators will have done the job explaining what these are. Or in his own classes that he was teaching, he would explain it to the students, and then he did not care to put them down in the sutras. What he did was, he took all these 10 yamas and niyamas and gave us what kind of results you will get if you were to follow those guidelines. For example, ahimsa. Once you follow ahimsa to the ultimate extreme, what will happen to you? Satya, aste, etc., etc. Or each one, what kind of siddhis you might get, what kind of supernormal powers you can get, or what will be your state when you have been fully established in those values. That's what he is giving us. Okay? Take a sip here. So the Sanskrit is, in this sutra is ahimsa pratishthayam tat sannidhau vairatyagah. So ahimsa pratishthayam tat sannidhau vairatyagah. Okay, what does that mean now? Pratishthayam, one who is fully established in ahimsa. That means one who has completely immersed himself in the value of ahimsa. He has never done any violence. He doesn't have any thoughts of violence. He has never hurt anybody, he or she. Okay. And all those things, right? So one who is completely devoid of any form of violence, injury, hurt, or anything. What happens for that person? In his presence, sannidhau means in the presence. In his presence, vairatyagaha. That means, tyaga means giving up. And vaira means any kind of animosity. So, absolutely, no animosity will be shown to him by anybody. If you have given up violence, nobody else will have any violent thoughts against you, towards you. Okay. Now, all these 10 statements that Patanjali makes, they are not easy to explain. The commentators have gone all over the place in trying to explain these things. What does it mean and all that? Okay. In this, you know, there are many stories that have been kind of given as examples. One of the stories that I remember, you know, there was a in the Gujarati community in India, there is a sect called Swami Narayan. Anybody heard of that? Swami Narayan. Okay. Now, Swami Narayan himself lived, what, 200 years ago or something like that? Roughly, right? And his childhood name was Neelakantha. I don't know. Anybody know that story?
Yes. He went to see the Akshardham.
You saw the movie?
No, in Delhi.
Yeah, you saw the Akshardham.
Beautiful place.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
Neelakantha, Akshardham.
Yeah, okay. So the story goes like this. You know, this guy, this kid, at the age of 11, he lost his parents, and then he decided to just leave his house and search for truth, as they say, you know, at the age of 11. So he started walking, and he would go from village to village to village to village, and then he was a very keen observer, learner, and he had actually studied all the Vedas at a very young age. So he, by the age of 11, he was already kind of well-versed in the scriptural knowledge and all that. So he knew everything. And then he would go in from village to village and maybe talk to people, all these yogis there, etc. In one village, when he went there, he was obviously going to people's homes and eating food there, etc. So he reached there in the evening, and the villagers told him, look, this village is not a safe place, because there's a lion or tiger or whoever, you know, that comes every evening, and if the tiger finds anybody outdoors, the tiger can hurt that person, injure him. So you should go inside and, you know, live in somebody's house, not staying out. He used to, you know, always live outside. He would sit under a tree and then spend the night there and then go and have food somewhere. That's how normally all these mendicants do anyway. All right. But this guy said, look, this is my ritual. I have to perform my puja, my meditation, and I will take food from you, but I'll sit under the tree and then do it. They said to you, it's a very dangerous place. He said, I'm okay. If I'm not there tomorrow, I'm okay with that. No worries. So this guy, you know, on that big platform under a big people tree, he sits there and starts his meditation and all that. And in the morning, you know, when they know that the tiger would have, you know, gone back by that time, the villagers come out of their houses, huts or whatever, and guess what they find? This guy is sitting under that tree in a state of meditation, and this tiger is sitting at his feet, right next to him. Very peaceful. No problems. And I don't know if you saw that movie, because in that movie they show that scene.
It's very beautiful.
It's a good movie to see that.
I think it's on the internet too.
I'm possibly.
Sure, if you put it.
Does karma figure in Patanjali?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Does he discuss it, or does he expect you to argue?
No, no, no. He discusses it.
Okay.
Chapter 2, part of it is karma theory. He does discuss it, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Karma theory, reincarnation, all these concepts are a part of yoga philosophy given by Patanjali. And chapter 2 discusses them. Yeah. So again, the theory is that because he was so well established in ahimsa, non-violence, even the most violent animal became subservient to this guy. A similar story is told about Buddha, you know, people who wanted to hurt him, you know. There's a very famous story about Angulimala, you know, I don't know if anybody remembers that. You remember that?
Yeah.
The guy who used to have, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He became a complete subservient to Buddha just because, you know, his presence. Because Buddha himself was totally established in ahimsa, non-violence. Other people, they left their ideas of violence. And there was another story related to same thing, that somebody came to kill him. And as soon as they saw him, he just fell at his feet. Nowhere. And there are many other stories of people who, you know, the people claim they were going in a forest and then suddenly attacked by a snake. But this guy sat in meditation, the snake also sat by him in meditation. So, I mean, these stories are there, whether they're believable or not, but the idea is that if you are fully established in ahimsa, you have no fear of being hurt or attacked or anything. Because people give up their idea of violence in your presence. Okay. So what does ahimsa mean? Ahimsa is towards all living creatures, plants, animals, humans, everything. We can just read through this, you know. Do you want to read one line at a time?
Ahimsa toward all living creatures, plants, animals, humans. Evil tendencies like selfishness, hatred, jealousy, anger, etc. cause tendency to inflict injury to others.
We understand that, right? That's what he says. Hinsa, dayaha, all these negative thoughts, vitarkas.
To nourish one's own body with the flesh of another is himsa, or violence.
Okay, I'm going to stop here. Now, this is the origin of the concept of non-meat eating. You know, there is a whole concept of vegetarianism, non-meat eating, and especially in India, there are certain groups of certain people within the country. They follow this non-meat eating very strongly, very religiously. Okay, and the concept is ahimsa, because eating meat means you would have caused harm to an animal, which is a living being. Although I went and did some research and I found no scriptural testimony, you know, none of the, at least to my knowledge, I could not find it in the Vedas, I could not find it in the Mahabharata or Ramayana or Yoga Sutra or any other major scripture that we refer to, where it says categorically, do not eat meat. And I'm still looking for some reference. If somebody finds it, please let me know, because I would like to find out. So far, I haven't. In fact, in Ramayana, I went and read, oh, Rama was a meat eater. Go figure. I never thought that.
He was a Kshatriya.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever, what I'm saying is, you know, my feeling was, he was such a god, he should have been a non-meat eater. But then I went and read Ramayana. No, he used to eat meat. He drank wine, everything.
I think it was more of a functional thing, because Kshatriyas were protecting the community and they were out in the jungles and there was no way they could eat. So they were allowed to eat meat.
Right.
And all the rishis also.
Well, that's what I'm saying. There is no injunction anywhere that I've seen which says do not eat meat. Same thing in Mahabharata. I haven't seen it anywhere in that. There's no mention.
At least with the time itself, that himsa is also through thought, speech, everything.
Yes.
It's not just
eating. Yeah, you're right. But anyway, I just wanted to stop there because I would like to find out. Okay, go ahead.
Inflicting pain for one's own comfort is himsa. Violence. Ahimsa through action, thought, and speech, as the thoughts, so the actions, so purify thoughts.
So we can do ahimsa, you know, we can do violence through our body, thought, and speech. Okay, body, everyone knows I can kick somebody, hurt somebody, you know, shoot somebody, that's body. Thought, my facial expression sometimes can tell whether I'm having violent thoughts or not. You don't have to say anything. I know. And speech, of course, is the most dangerous. Speech, whatever you say through words, is the longest lasting hurt that you can cause to anybody. I mean, people say something and it lasts for their lifetime. You know, that's the most.
Now, in that second bullet, it talks about these evil tendencies to inflict injury to others. But what about having the selfishness yourself and therefore hurting
yourself? That's a part of the whole
thing.
That's violence. Hurting yourself is violence. Absolutely. Go ahead.
Apply ahimsa not only to yourself, not only to others, but to yourself as well. For example, hurting yourself by overeating. Okay, so
hey,
you good. By overeating, performing asana beyond your capability, etc.
We do that all the time. I mention this because people think that ahimsa simply means that you don't hurt others, but you are yourself hurting yourself by doing all these things, and we do it all the time. In fact, that is more dangerous than anything else. We hurt ourselves more than anybody else.
Doesn't Patanjali say one of them, sthiram sukhamasanam? Isn't it one of those
where yes.
He says you don't have to, it's not like pain, no gain, that's what the Western thought is. Unless you really exercise to the limit, you're not going to gain anything, whereas it's opposite in yoga, right?
Absolutely.
Sthiram sukhamasanam.
If there is pain, there is no gain.
Self-destructive behavior caused by fear or guilt. Food wastage is a form of violence against those who sleep hungry. love involving demands and expectations entails violence, both to self and others. Emotional violence in relationships, harsh, abusive language, angry outbursts, emotional judgments, sarcasm, skillful manipulations. As the yogi becomes established in ahimsa, all beings coming near him cease to be hostile.
Okay, does it all make some sense?
What's the source of these statements?
They're not on the book here, are they? No. Some of them are my thoughts. Some of them are based on commentaries I've read. You know, this is just different commentaries that I read, and I pick up one bullet from here, one bullet from here, and then add some of my own bullets.
Take a picture of that. Just this picture.
This is available to you. I'm going to. All this is going to be sent to you. This.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Everything.
We have slides out there online too.
I already have these slides online. Everything is online. Okay. I put everything online. There's nothing hidden.
This is
cute. I mean, like I said, even this audio recording will be online, so you will have that. Okay. This is what we did last time, and I'm going to stop here after this because I'm getting a little tired myself. So we are going to stop exactly at the same spot that we stopped last time. Okay, so the sutra is, repeat, satya pratishthayam kriya phala ashrayatvam. Okay, one more time. Satya pratishthayam kriya phala ashrayatvam. Okay, what does it mean? Dave, you want to read the meaning?
To one established in truthfulness, actions and their results become subservient.
Now, every commentator on this sutra has a different take on what this might mean. Okay. So, it's your interpretation, basically. Some feel that when you are established in satya, you can dictate anything that you want. Whatever the word you speak will come true. Okay? And this is how they say these yogis in the past, they used to give boons or, blessings and things like that. You know, remember in the old days, they would say, you become this and they will become that. And that's because they were completely established in satya, they say. That's the example they give. That they were so truthful in their own self that they could command whatever they wished. So whatever they wished or whatever they said or statement they made, it came true. That's one of the commentators, one of the interpretations of this sutra. Okay. The other is that kriya phala, kriya is whatever actions you do. Kriya is the activities that you, kriya phala is the outcome of your activities. Okay? Then, ashrayatva means based on. Ashraya is based on or dependent on. That means once you are established in satya, then whatever actions you do, the results of that will be dependent on your desire. You could kind of mold the outcome of your own actions. I mean, there are other interpretations. There's no reason to go into all that. I think you get the idea that if you are established in satya, if you're fully established in satya, you can basically determine the outcome of your own statements or your actions. All right? That's what the most common interpretation is for this statement. Okay, so you want to read the next slide?
Satya, the truthfulness, speech and mind conforming to reality as seen, inferred or heard, action that conveys the reality as is. Speech should not be deceptive, confused, equivocal, barren of a meaning, or hurtful. Avoid unpleasant truth or pleasant untruth.
Now, this is another statement. It comes from an ancient text. Avoid unpleasant truth and pleasant untruth. Okay? It's if it should not be deceptive, right? You should not be saying deceptive words. Confused speech. What is equivocal? Two meanings. Double meaning. Avoid that. Barren of a meaning. Barren of a meaning is sometimes, you know, people use very lofty words and they don't mean anything, but they just want to show off their knowledge of English or some language, and they use words which don't mean much, but they sound very flowery and all that. Or hurtful. So, unpleasant truth. If, let's say you, you know, somebody was running and he...
Do the jeans make me look fat?
There you go. Something like that. Some people tell, oh, you're looking very pretty today, you know. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay. Yeah. Pleasant untruth. Oh, you've lost weight. You never know.
You just
say that.
Brownie points. Okay.
Yeah, brownie points.
Luxury of imagination in favor of pure objectivity. False ego hides the true voice of intuition. Everyone has their own perception of truth. When established in truth, fruit of action depend upon the action of the yogi.
All right. Any other thoughts on this one? Like I said, I've kind of compiled these based on some of the commentators and what they write and some of my own thoughts.
I'd like to know more about the false ego hides the true voice of intuition.
Right, false ego. Like I said, the ego does not like intuition. Because if it allows the intuition to play a role, then ego cannot look at those labels and then start, you know, putting things in place. Ego loves those labels. It wants to do things based on what you liked in the past or what you disliked in the past. Whereas pure intuition will tell you what is good for you at this very moment. So ego will hide all that.
So I think intuition is what you feel is the right thing to do, but then ego gets in the way.
Yes.
Because you want to please yourself.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by
well, ego is always false in that sense.
That's what I thought you were saying.
Yeah. Normally the ego is false because it's only looking at those labels. But when it is pure, when it is pure ego, that's when it has been put in its own place and it knows exactly what its function is and doesn't transgress its function. That's what it is. Okay, like I said, I would like to stop here. In closing, we'll recite Om once now. So take a deep breath in. Again, do the invocation to Sage Patanjali. Yogena chittasya padena vacham malam sharirasya cha vaidyakena yopakarottam pravaram muninam patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. Patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. Shanti mantra. Om asatoma sadgamaya tamasoma jyotirgamaya mrityorma amritam gamaya. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Thank you all very much.